Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today, as on some other days, some other episodes, we've got not one, but two guests for some inspiration and empowerment for you today. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Jody and Josh. And welcome to the show, guys. Just pretend that we haven't been talking about really interesting stuff for the last half hour, and just pretend that, you know, this is the first time that we've said hello. Hello, Jody. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Simon. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Thank you so much. We're in for some fascinating stuff here, and you'll, listeners, you'll figure out, you'll see why it's going to be fascinating when Jody, you hear a little bit more about Jody and Josh. So, Jody, could you introduce yourself first, please, to the listeners?
Sure. So my name is Jody Gill, and I work with the adoptee community under an organization called the Adoptee Group. And our focus is on mental health, and exactly what your focus is, to look at thriving adoptees and to help people to wellness.
Yeah. And you're an adoptee as well, aren't you, Jody?
Yes, I'm an adoptee from South Korea. I was adopted in 1976 at the age of two into a family with three older siblings who were biological sons of my parents. And generally speaking, I had a great experience with my adoptive family. Back then in the 70s and 80s, there were certainly common racial tensions, racial remarks that thankfully we've improved as a society. I think though for me, you know, my adoption, if I was to call them issues, were probably most contemplated after I had children. So currently, I should probably just give you the stats. I was married pretty young in my mind. I was married at age 21. I had my first child at age 23. And by age 26, I had three children. I've been married for 26 years. And my youngest one is 21, about to turn 21. My middle one is 22. And my oldest one is 23.
Right. Fantastic. Yeah, so that's interesting, isn't it? I read a lot about that, the fact that when adoptees have kids, that's often when these issues come up. So in for an interesting show today, guys. Josh, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, my name is Joshua Heitzman. I'm always very appreciative to Jody for bringing me on to the TAG network. She asked me because of my background in clinical psychology, if I could help with the mental health component. And obviously that's kind of a no-brainer for me, is that if I can help in any way in that kind of department, you know, I think it's so important as far as for what we're doing. Like Jody, I was adopted. I'm a Korean adoptee. I was adopted at 3 and a half, actually found on the streets of Seoul, South Korea, at 2 and a half. So I was in an orphanage for about a year before I'm being adopted, and then was adopted into a small rural Caucasian community. So I grew up, my town was in California, 1,200 people. So it's really small town. California, as far as in the United States, is not always thought of as being rural, but there are a lot of rural areas because it's a big state. So, but I grew up to a German and German-Russian family. So they're from the Midwest. And so grew up very rural, Caucasian, German, thought most of my life that I was actually German, and speak more German than I do Korean. And so, and like Jody, I had, you know, there was always racial tensions, but I think in a rural community, it's a little bit different in the sense that family and that kind of orientation is more about status. So my dad was a police officer and my mom was a teacher in the community for years. So that kind of overrode that I was Korean, But it also, as I have, gone on and moved on, is that it is also the same thing that keeps us, the racial tensions there, and it's something that like you said, Simon, about when you have kids, when I did have my son who's 7 now, it kind of changes your perspective on what the adoption means to me, but to other folks as well. So,
yeah,
I think that's where I kind of appreciated Jody. It's been a journey for me in this process as well, because I'm pretty new to the adoption research, and especially the Korean adoption research, and not by choice, but just it hasn't been something that I've been self-perpetuated to do. So, but it's been interesting getting into it.
Yeah. And Josh is actually a neuropsychologist. So he's the first neuropsychologist that I've met. And an incredible warmth for a guy that spends, neuropsychologists, I thought that they would be kind of very scientific, white coat, kind of left brain, like that. So you've got an incredible warmth and the ability to talk about this stuff in using words that somebody like I can understand. It's great. So welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
So I like to ask guests what comes to their mind when they hear this word, thriving adoptees. So perhaps we could start with you, Jody. What comes to your mind when you hear that word, thriving adoptees?
Adoptees who don't give up, willing to hang out in a relational sense. And I don't have the background that Josh has, but I can recognize in the community how we are so quick to drop friendships, so quick to run away when we don't feel like we're in control or we feel threatened that someone's going to leave us. I think that's part of it, is how do we work within ourselves to be able to thrive in our relationships, because that carries out through our professional lives, through our personal lives, and for raising children too.
Yeah. That's really landed for me, Jody, what you just said then. Because, I've felt that actually. Nobody's ever, they're quick to drop relationship stuff, but friendships actually, but yeah, also romantic relationship. I've been with my wife since 1993, so we've been together a long time, but there was a stage, yeah, that's nobody's put it as succinctly as that, so that's really landed for me. I didn't think I didn't even know that was a thing.
I think it's a simple response, yet it can go so far. I see such potential in individuals and their skill sets with, in their personal skill sets with other people and in their professional skill sets. So when they drop people because either they feel threatened or if they feel, a certain kind of feeling, I think, okay, they're an adoptee. As strong as we want to look on the outside, there are some sensitivities that if we know they're an adoptee, then we've, in some ways, those who are maybe at a different place need to take care of them and give them that second or third or fourth chance and let them process that, but let them know that you're going to be there. I'm not leaving. Just let me know when you want to chat again. I think that serves the community well.
Wow. Josh, what does thriving adoptees mean to you?
Well, and Jody and I have had these conversations, and I always appreciate being able to talk with Jody and some of the other adoptees, because a lot of times it depends on who you're with and who you're working with. But a lot of times we find that we focus on the many adoptees that aren't doing so well. And I think that's where I come in, is that yes, there are adoptees that are in need of mental health services and are in that category where they need professional help or at least that support. But there are a lot of adoptees out there that are, I mean, you look at Jody and you look at, you know, if you look at our board and the things that some of the folks have done, it's amazing. And we don't always hear those stories. So I think what the thriving part is that I think it's kind of our blessing and our curse, as I'll speak for Korean adoptees, is that we do a lot of things and we're pretty successful in a lot of ways. We're not always in your face about it, right? And I think part of it is us getting out there and trying to help other people, especially, you know, other adoptees, really encouraging them to, you know, like Jody said, is really kind of on their terms, but through our experience, help them to realize that they are worth something, you know. And I think that's the big part, is that there's been a lot of battles where, you know, where Jody and I, you know, it's like we do these incredible things and we're in these positions of power and these kinds of things. And sometimes we have to realize that, are we doing it for ourselves or are we doing it for something or someone else? You know, and it becomes a worth issue, you know, of, am I doing this because I'm worth it, or am I doing it to show someone I'm worth it? You know, so I think there's a big difference between them. And I think that's what I've learned through doing this research and helping Jody out, is that, why am I doing this? And if I'm doing it because I think I'm worth it and I think others are worth it, I think that's a good cause. But if I'm doing it just because and just going through the patterns of things because that's what's expected, I think that's me kind of living a little bit in a lie. So I think there's kind of some truth finding as far as my journey into what I'm getting into as far as helping other Korean adoptees and adoptees in general.
Yeah. I want to just give kind of my take on that last bit and where I'm at, just before we get into the rest of it. So I struggled. I learned some stuff. I decided I want to share it with others.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a huge part of the equation. Why would we want to help other people? It's because we've already gone through some really hard struggles ourselves, and we've been able to come to some point of, you know, control, I guess, temperament, control of our temperament. And it's a worthy cause,
yeah,
to help other people.
And that trend, struggled, learnt, shared, somebody put it really succinctly. I heard this about 6 months ago. Your mess becomes your message.
Yes.
Your poop becomes manure. Yeah. Mm. Your poop becomes manure to help other people grow. That is very common in anybody that wants to help other people, coach other people, people that come to it later in life. So, you know, some people say, right, you know, I want to be, they decide that they want to be a doctor or a nurse, or they want to be a teacher or something like that in the helping profession when they're a kid. That's one kind of pattern. But the people that went through some struggles and then came out the other side and want to help others, like shine the light for somebody else, that is common across like loads and loads of people that I've seen in the kind of the coaching space. And I would say it's the predominant, background that I've seen. It's interesting that even though we're, what Josh was saying is, as a if you put if you take what I've said there as being something I've seen in non-adoptee circles, and then you put an adoptee lens on it and you say, you question yourself, am I doing this for selfish reasons, mm-hmm. or am I doing this for altruistic reasons? I came to do this for altruistic reasons. That's what I've been doing for the last 10 years in whole, it's a different, in different spheres, notably working in elementary schools, nothing to do with adoption. But since I found the adoption space and actually found people that wanted to talk about this stuff, people that were going to prioritize this stuff, my life is about 1,000 times better.
And I think that's the, Jody had mentioned it before, I think that is the part that we don't get until we get into it, get involved, is that, you know, there were many times where I thought I was alone, like I'm a unique story, right? That I am like, gosh, there's no one out there like me. And then, you know, jumping onto some Korean adoptee groups and being able to meet some Korean adoptees and other adoptees too, not just Korean adoptees, but, you know, getting kind of back to this, you hear these stories and it's like you can laugh about things that are just really similar. But you can also get inside of how things are very different as well. But I think the common theme of that whole thing is that we're not alone, right? Is that we're not as unique as we think we are. And I think hearing other people's stories, we start realizing that we can impact people in different ways without even knowing it, just by telling our stories, right? Just by reaching out to people. And I think that's, you know, they may not come back to you and say, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, or they may. But I also think that somewhere out there hearing, you know, and that's why I'm so interested in kind of doing more media like podcasts and these kinds of things, is that someone hears a story and that could be the one story that they hear that turns things around, you know, or you know, or connection or something like that. So I think it's really important. And I think for us to get out there and communicate that people aren't alone is a big message, a simple one, but a big one.
Indeed. I love the inspirational nature of the stories. And, you know, going from your story, Josh, you know, being found on the streets of Seoul at 2.5 years old, and then landing in California a year and a half later, whatever it was, being in the sticks, I just thought that must have been a shock to the system. But more than anything, I was thinking about this poor little lad at 2.5 wandering around the streets of Seoul. It's a, you know, 2.5. It's like, wow, you know, it's look how far you've come, pal.
Well, I it's not an uncommon story that, you know, and I'll tell you that among the adopted community, and I used to think it was so unique, but you know, when the reality comes, when you see your papers, and you know, my mom brings me my papers and they say abandoned child, you know, and for some reason that word abandoned was just like, you know, there's so much in one word, you know, especially on your papers, right? Your adoption papers, and that's how they found you. So it's just, yeah, it's definitely simple, but very complex. And the stories out there for Korean adoptees, there's just so many of them that you just wonder how folks get to be where they're at, despite those kinds of things. And I think for, you know, for Jody's cause, that's why I was so excited about it, is that she's really trying to push the other folks that are, that need maybe just that little bump, or like she said, that little bit of, hey, I'm here, you talk to me later. And that might be the one thing that changes the life of that person, the trajectory of that. So, you know, I think that's what that comes from. And and like you said, that altruistic kind of being. But I'll say for me is that that altruistic being also needs to sit back and make sure that I do some self-care on these journeys, right? That you give, and then soon you don't have enough left for yourself. And so I think that's also important to be able to, along the journey, sit back and make sure that you're tending to yourself as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel that I am tending to myself in these conversations. I spend all my time on Zooms, and that is I don't need to. That is my self care. Conversation is self care, I guess. Yeah. So we like to bring the inspirational stories here, and clearly we have two inspirational characters. We also like to hear guests on today, both of you guys. I also like to bring the empowerment piece as well. So the Thriving Adoptee show is about sharing what we've learned that helps adoptees thrive. So would you like to take a go at that, Jody? What is it that you would like to share with the adoptees who are listening? If we focus it in on the adoptees, this particular show, rather than adopted parents, this episode, that would be great. What is it that you've learned that helps adoptees thrive?
Well, I entered into the adoption community in 2020 and experienced really a great, all the different flavors of adoption and adoptees, and poured myself into books. Near the end of that year, one of my friends, Mark, gave me an article, and in that article was a chart that explained, out of the fog. And it was like this U-shaped chart that explained the different stages of the fog. And that was a new concept for me. So for me, it was a moment where it was like this rewind of my entire life and truly looking at why all these questions, why did I act like that? Why did I behave like that? Putting it to full circle. And then I guess it was kind of an aha moment to change that narrative of, okay, this is what it was, and this is based on this and my simplistic gathering of information. So let's change the narrative. And I think that is what we have as adoptees, is maybe we weren't in control of the narrative in the beginning of our lives, but as grown adoptees with a community of support, we can do that. And that's what I've learned, is people have said, well, what do you want it to be? And it's like, I have a choice. I've lived my life, whether it was through adoptee trauma or not, but trying to seek approval from other people so that I would be, accepted, really. I was an overachiever so that I could be accepted. I have a low tolerance or low patience because of, different things that happened in my life, or maybe it was just the way I was born. But we get an opportunity as adoptees to change that narrative, almost like put a vision board out there. This is how it's going to end. And we can strive toward that goal.
Yeah. I put a post in an adoptee group on Facebook a couple of months ago. And it said, adoption is something that happened to us. It doesn't define us. And I got 120 likes, 20 loves, and then 20 people saying, how dare you? You're denying my experience.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you think that is? What's the difference that makes the difference?
There's a journey. And in my position, I would want to recognize that journey and not take it as a complication. But those who are saying, like, why would you invalidate my truth? I would probably just personal message them and explain a little more, because when they have that one-on-one conversation, sometimes you can kind of bring that temperament down and hear each other out. But they're in a different place in their journey, and that's just what it is.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to also, you know, for me, it's as a psychologist, it's looking at kind of these developmental lines, these kind of stages that people are. And because you don't know the backgrounds of those people who comment, like Jody said, you don't know where they're at in the journey. I mean, I look at something like that you wrote, and if I was in college, I probably would have written that, right? Like, I think about how angry I was at a certain stage, right? Where it was just like, you put that up and who are you to tell me what my adoption story is, right? And all well-intentioned. Like, it's, you know, it's not like you put it out there like, ah, ha, 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 here's this quote that I think everyone should live by. But it is one of those things that, and I think that's what can really help other folks, right? Your story, Simon, is as, you know, when you had said that kind of things started getting more difficult, right? Is that despite successful things that were happening in your life, it was a difficult time for you. And I think for a lot of folks, if there is a group of adoptees that could really just be there for these folks, right? To not tell them what to do, but to conversate with them, right? You're talking about how conversation is your self-care. Well, it probably is for a lot of folks who are adopted, right? Just to be able to be like, you know, what was it like, you know, them bouncing questions off you? You know, what was it like when you were in college, right? You weren't always the way that you are. And for me to be able to express that story, have someone else where it's like, hey, you know, you need to talk to my other adoptee friend. I think they would be really, they went through this and they may be able to preemptively help you at least listen, right? And I think that's the biggest part and the challenge of adoptees is that we just need to listen sometimes. You know, we don't need to give advice. We don't need to send them to a psychiatric care facility or give them medication. Sometimes the medication is just that conversation. And I think that's what I've learned as far as kind of how this thing unfolds is just to hear people.
So we were talking, yeah, I mean, Facebook isn't always the place for conversation, isn't it? It's like, it seems to be quite loaded in some places and groups like your own, where there's a little bit more space, there's a little bit more thriving. There's a little bit more focus. There's a focus on the positive. There's a focus on moving forward. That's where we should be. I did a podcast on Friday. I did a recording on Friday. And, you know, I think I said something like, you know, the support groups and support groups. You really need something that's a little bit more, where there's a closer connection, not just, I mean, 7,000 people in that group. We were talking before we started the recording about pinning the tail on the wrong donkey, which is my shorthand, somewhat clumsy way of saying, you know, attributing things to adoption. And I feel that sometimes I have attributed stuff to adoption, which has nothing to do with adoption. It's about being human. I was wondering if you could talk into that. Does that make any sense?
As in the trauma that we, or our behaviors we claim is based on adoptee trauma when it could just be.
Yeah, it can be a rabbit hole to go down, can't it? Hmm. To try and isolate the cause of a behavior or
It's a tough one because I see, you know, they're somewhat classified in a casual sense as angry adoptees. And we look at their posts and we're like thinking, wow, but is some of that just human nature, the journey of a human and less trauma? But how would you know? That's a tough question.
I think it has to be a personal one. I guess I'm putting it out there because one of the things that I've learned is that sometimes I attribute behavior to being adopted, which is about being human. So I've made that mistake. And that was actually one of the biggest lessons I got from Nancy Verrio's book. So when I read The Primal Wound, I thought this explains everything. But then I thought I was stuck with it. I found that book disempowering because it almost like my fate was sealed by virtue of something that had happened 48, so 48 years beforehand. And then, so, I mean, some of the essential lessons that I took from it, or the inferences that I drew, the conclusions that I drew from her book, right? These are just my conclusions. She has a whole load of other stuff. So she said, adoptees don't like being rejected. Adoptees want to control things, and adoptees don't like change. And I had a eureka moment about, I don't know, 6 months after reading that book, when I realized that nobody likes being rejected. Nobody particularly likes change, and everybody's trying to control stuff. So in my world, that freed me enormously, realizing that I was no longer disempowered. And I'm wondering whether you could take your learnings and your lessons and what you've figured out about that stuff or that topic.
It's like Jody said, this is territory that's, you know, that we've, I think, as crate adoptees, at least in my case, I understand will be a lifelong journey for me, right? To kind of figure these things out. As far as the clinical part, and I always try to kind of map that out, is that it's why we really look at, the association and not the cause, right? So I want to make that clear because, you know, I think the way that you were thinking about things before was that this caused this, right? And a lot of adoption research is more about association. Like if you were adopted, you're much more likely to do this, right? Mm-hmm. Or that the chances are greater that you will do this. But it's not caused by adoption, right? So just because you're adopted doesn't mean that you will do this. But it's most likely you will, because the context kind of sets you up for that. The rest is determined by biology. But what I take from that is that, and I'll compare it to trauma, is that if you don't have anything else to control, so if you're adopted, we don't have a choice in it, right? That's some other person's choice, right? And our hope would be that those people made that choice by some circumstance, right? Like a loss of a job or, you know, some tragic kinds of thing. And in this journey as a Korean adoptee, I've been uncovering that a lot of these stories aren't the narrative that we create. And I don't want to be dark in that sense, and I won't, talk about a lot, but a lot of the story that we create about, oh gosh, my mom must have really loved me, or my parents created. Like, you must have really been loved because, you know, you like hugging me or kissing me, or, you know, or you're very affectionate. But those things are really learned, right? And learned in a context that you have no control over being in that context. And so it's interesting because the only way that I found that I could adapt is to control what I did, right? Overly, right? Kind of like Jody was saying, is that overachievement, right? I mean, I kind of kept that going in our community, which was all Caucasian, right? It's like, oh, there's Heitzman, the Asian kid that's like 4.1 GPA, you know, like all these, you know, he's in sports, he's in music, he's doing this, you know? And, you know, for me, I love to hunt and fish, you know, and is that, I've had that conversation with Jody and other adoptees. Is that because my dad loves to fish and hunt? Or is it because I really love to hunt and fish? You know, and so I think that is just one of those things where it's like, I can control that narrative by just doing it and appease my parents, right? Because they love it. So, you know, the one thing that I do have to say is that my son loves fishing more than I do. So, but again, is that me loving fishing, passing it on to him through my dad, or is it that he truly loves fishing? So I think for me, psychologically, it's like a nightmare for me because I always try to figure these things out. And there's, I miss the joy of him actually being outdoors. So I think we have to be careful in that. But the controlling the context, you know, I mean, that's just, if you think about it, if you don't have any other choice, you know, I don't know if you've ever read Viktor Frankl's work.
Yeah.
So, it's the one. You know, the meaning of life, right? Yeah. And he has a second, and then now he has, I think his daughter or his granddaughter just came out with another version of that. It's kind of like that, right? I mean, it is that as dark as the concentration camps were that he was in, there was choice. And it's what you made of that choice that really got folks to live or and find meaning or not. And so, you know, I think thinking of in those terms, it's like that was one of the most dark parts of history and no choice. So relatively, it's like my story, you know, other Korean adoptee stories are just, they're comparable, but not really to that situation. But I think the point is that there is choice in things. And the way that we have choice, it may be two of the worst choices ever, but we still get to choose. And I think that that's kind of where I'm starting to go, is that I have choice in what I do. I don't have to do it because, right? I don't have to do it because my parents want me to do it. And so that's kind of what I've been learning as I go about how I, what kinds of things that I get involved in and what I contribute.
Yeah. So do you catch yourself falling down the rabbit hole of looking for cause and effect more than you used to do, or do you still end up
as a neuropsychologist, I always fall down that hole, and I'm afraid going to be my because when Jody brought me on, she's like, you know, I need some of these numbers and these, and immediately I go to the research, right? So, and I call out people, and I've been on you know, Zoom calls with some of the leading researchers in Korean adoption, you know, and talking to them, just getting some insight of all the work that they're doing too, but also their experience as an academic or a professional. So I always go through that, and you know, I probably bore Jody with some of the, you know, I'm just like, well, the numbers show this, and my nerdy side comes out. So
have you? But,
there's just no end. That's what I've realized. Okay, what can we showcase today?
Have you seen the stuff from the professor of the Harvard medical school? He lectures somewhere else as well, or researches lectures on him, saying there's no there's clinical evidence of the primal wound, but there's no scientific evidence of it. Have you heard that?
Yes. and that is another rabbit hole too. So
that's another rabbit hole. Should we avoid that? I'm going to bring it back to choice. Okay. So this is a stunningly simple truism that was the start of my journey, right? Start of my learning journey. Most of us aren't choosing how we behave, how we feel, or how we think most of the time. So if it so if we're not choosing, it's not our fault. Now, and we're not our story. You know, Jody was talking about choosing the narrative, changing the narrative. You know, I can choose a narrative. So I spent a week on that stuff. I spent a week on those three things that I just said. Well, two things. That we're not choosing, so it's not our fault, and that we're not our story. We're not the story. We're not our. So if we're not choosing, then what's happening is our conditioning is choosing for us. So I wanted to ask you, Jody, about choosing the narrative, because we can't. I mean, the past obviously is done and dusted. We can't change that, but we can choose to have a different future, or choose how we see the past, or change the narrative. What would you say about that, Jody? What's your take on that?
I think I mentioned vision board, like we put a vision out there and we can strive toward it. I think we have to override our feelings at times, and it's just pure discipline. I'm going to take this time period and do this, and I'm going to take this time period and do this. And I think I'm talking more in a sense of like character and generosity and goals that do help us thrive. But what do we do in our daytime with our hours that are given to us, that we can't truly rely on the feeling that we're having at that moment? But I think it's like, we may not achieve that goal at 100%, but even if we make it at 50%, whatever those goals are, that's still better than where we were. Yeah. And that's the point, is it's not, nothing is absolute when in our minds, if we have, especially if we struggle with, you know, any kind of clinical mental health conditions, we have to take all those things into account. Well, maybe moving 3 to 5 steps from where you were a week or a month before, that's the win. And so because I have children who have done sports, who have done music, we would never look at it after a basketball game and say, like, you know, you should have scored better. It's more like, oh, look at that assist that you did to that person who made so many layups throughout the game. So it's about taking those baby steps and recognizing those, and reminding ourselves and the people around us, that was a win, that was a win, that was a win. So that, and maybe that feeling would change the motivation to continue forward. But I do think we have some control. So I disagree with that. And maybe it's just that we don't have control of getting the exact result that we want. But I think that we are very capable of getting a percentage of that result.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you talk about a high achiever. I wouldn't classify myself as a high achiever. Maybe that's the difference between the two. Maybe that's why you're a high achiever, because you think that you've got more control than I. That's an interesting one.
Josh can correct me. That's why I like having Josh at the table. He brings a great element to understood.
So, you know, I think the conundrum is when we talk about adoptees, is like, I feel like all my research, all the training, it goes out the window, right? I just sometimes I'm pleasantly confused with things that happen, and it doesn't always sit well with me, but I think that's what we need, right? Is that I think we do need to be able to, and I'll go back to what you said, Simon, is to conversate, right? To talk to people. And I think that's a lot more healing than telling people, you know, what they do or don't think, or, you know, or what's right, what's wrong. You know, I think just to have these conversations are just really enlightening, to hear what people think, you know, and what people are doing with what they have.
Yeah. You talked earlier on about, you know, the good news stories, the adoption good news stories aren't shared much. Waving the flag really for adoptees and the success. One of the things that fascinates me is that, you know, there's a lot of kids do this stuff called life story work. I don't know whether they do it in the US as much as we do in the UK. It's all about life story work, but it's all about the past. Now, what about the future? What about, you know, like Jody's talking about creating vision boards and looking forward, you know, why aren't we doing more of that? Or is my take on it a bit skewed? I'm a bit off. It seems to me there's a lot of looking back and there's not much looking forward. You know, how is that kind of, that's just my take. How accurate am I in my take on that, would you say? Or does it matter?
I'll say it matters a lot. I think what you're talking about is for us in the US, a lot of our kind of narratives, there's a lot of narrative kind of work that it's done in psychology, but a lot of it that's also kind of built around what we call genograms. So and we'll take a note of family history, right? And you know, I'll work with some kids with trauma that they don't even know who is in their lives. And they find out, you know, that their mother is actually their aunt, you know, these kinds of things. Or, you know, I've had kids that have battled kind of substance abuse. But when they look back, they see 8 people in their family have substance abuse. And like you, it's freeing, right? To think, God, it's not me. These people made bad decisions and now I'm stuck with that. And that kind of allows us to move forward, right? To be like, hey, that's kind of that turning point of, I was given this hand, right? But that doesn't mean that I have to keep that transmissible or going, right? And I think that, you know, it's a small slice of that, and there's a lot of complexity to that. But I think the focus shouldn't be on the past in the sense that if you are moving forward in a good direction, I think you're okay. But a lot of folks are moving in a not such a good, great direction. So how do you kind of change that? And a lot of it's by finding out kind of past history, right? It's a good predictor of future history or kind of future progress is we got to look at what's in our history so that we can kind of move forward and know our tendencies. And our pitfalls. One of the other things that I did want to mention for you, and I won't take too much time, if you ever get to read the author David Eagle, he's a neuroscientist, and he covers exactly what you're talking about, is are we in control of our consciousness, right? His book is called Incognito, and he has a lot of these ones that are meant for just a reader, not neuroscientific, you know, in all that sense, but kind of a story form. And he talks about this, and his finality is that we are not in control of who we are. And the reason being is that there's a lot of background noise in our brain, and the way neurons fire and these kinds of things, we put too much onus on what we control and what we don't. So we put all our eggs in the basket that we control what it is that we think we control, when really we're not so much. So we're pretty bad at that kind of angle if you're talking from a neuroscientist. And So it's just, it's a good read, or any of his work. He also works with time perception and these kinds of things. So something to kind of float your way. It's a good read. But
What was the surname? Guy's surname again?
The last name is Eagleman. So E-A-G. Okay. Yeah. L-E-M-A-N, and the first name is David. And all of his works are basically on he works on human perception as a neuropsychologist, but he or a neuroscientist, and he has these wonderful, they're like 100 pages, you know, short story kind of type, great reads, and great way to deliver neuroscientific work in a very palatable way.
So I've got a question for you, Josh. What's and this is, I do occasionally ask this. I've asked other people, but I've never asked a neuropsychologist. I'll ask it if I may. Where is the line between, and there might not be one, okay? Where is the line between understanding trauma and healing it, or going past it, or ignoring it, or whatever, you know, whatever kind of whatever story, however you see that, however you want to answer that question.
I'll open up by saying that I will never open up by saying I understand something. And the reason why I say that is because I can sit here and talk to you about trauma till the end of the world, whatever it is, right? Will I ever understand the trauma that you went through? Probably not. The part comes in, as you say, the healing of trauma is to be able to even know it's driving something inside of you. To being able to acknowledge that that something happened to you that that is probably not your fault. What you see in trauma a lot is this kind of shame, this blame, this guilt, right? That it's your fault, right? That because you're adopted, you're doing this, right? Well,
it's not our fault, guys.
It's not your fault.
It's not our fault.
Right.
But try getting an adoptee to recognize that, right? I think that's the biggest point, right? Is that it's not your fault, right? It's not your fault that other people couldn't, for whatever reason, take care of you,
yeah.
Right? And it's fortunate if we get into a scenario where we get folks who want to actually take that on, right? I mean, I think part of the balance is that I am completely indebted to my parents, but also I don't want to be chained to that either, right? So the part of trauma that you're, you know, the thing that you're talking about, right, is the one thing that everyone understands their own trauma very different. And where the hell am I as a psychologist trying to tell you what your trauma is or how to understand it? No. But I can tell you what you're going to experience, right? And if I can tell you and walk through you or walk with you about what it is that you'll probably experience, that helps, right? Because if you knew what the hell you were going to experience, like, you know, that for me, my own trauma is that my story goes that we had a translator that lived in our house with my parents for about 6 weeks. So we translated everything because I spoke Korean when I first came, didn't speak English. And I had told him that I was kicked underneath an overpass by some father figure. So I don't know if it was my father, uncle, it was some older male adult that he had kicked me and I had fallen in the street. And I have a scar right here that I had before that didn't happen in the US. And to this day, I cannot even walk under an overpass. So I'll be driving and my wife will even point out where the galvanic response or the skin response, the salt response or skin, it just makes me sweat. And my heart rate goes up, my blood pressure goes up, and I pass it and takes me a little bit and then come back down. That's just I'm not gonna say that's a small trauma because being kicked in the street, but the attribution that I had to an overpass is just, and a friend had sent me a picture of, there's a famous kind of overpass in Seoul. That's like it's kind of like the Eiffel Tower. Like if you get the reflection right, it's kind of like an oval, but it's typically just, you know, half of an oval. He sent me that picture and instantaneously I just started crying.
Wow.
And so I think part of that is that it's that response, right? And our narrative to make that, over the years, my mom has kind of changed the story on that. So I don't know what the real story is. So that's kind of what I talk about, is that, do I understand your trauma? Probably not, but I can help in the healing process of you reforming that narrative where you are in control of that. And that's, you may never get there. That's the honest truth, is that you may never get there. But folks like me sure as hell will try to help you in any way that we can deliver that. And that's what we're trying to do.
Sorry. I love that you say like walking with you, because that's what people want. They don't really want to be dictated to of how they should or should not feel, but to walk with you and let you know this could potentially happen given on whatever research or whatever information that we have. It's like you're giving them a map, and maybe it's helpful for them to calm down and to walk through that with you. You're building that trust with them.
Yeah. This we kind of need to bring it in to end, guys. We're gonna have to do another one, aren't we? I think
I don't think there's ever gonna be an end to kind of what we learn from this thing. You know, I think we all go through. I'll tell you, it's even since joining with Jody, it's been a change. You know, and I think part of it's I think the challenging thing is really not separating or trying to separate the clinical part of what I know and what I experience as an adoptee, because I think that's what we do, right? Is we try to split this apart. This is how I should feel, but this is how I am feeling. So what am I going to show you? I'm not going to show you how I really feel or experience it, because that's vulnerable, right? But I think that's maybe what we need more, is to be able to be vulnerable to folks, knowing that it's risky. But I think that's the separation that for me has been my personal struggle, is that I know everything about you clinically and I know what to do, but how do I get you there? And how do I share my experience to, in psychology, we don't share experiences. It's very, we're not supposed to share our own individual experience unless it's for the patient themselves. But I think in trauma work, all of our experience is the necessary work to heal somebody. So it's gonna be a journey, you know? And I think part of it is really having these kinds of things, and I really appreciate it, is that to be able to talk to people about their experiences, but also have us as a team, like Jody, just, you know, her ideas are just kind of mind blowing, you know, and I'm just along for that ride. And I'm glad I can help her on the clinical side. But, you know, I think what we don't realize is that along the way, we're meeting a lot of people that trigger a lot of things for us. And, you know, we need to make sure that we support our team in that way too.
So Jody, can you share a little bit more about the work you're doing with your group?
Yeah, the group is called the Adoptee Group, and it was formed by people who are altruistic and mission-driven. That's a huge importance, because when you bring in ego, it doesn't always go well. And we have a flagship program that's called TAG Network. We've got excellent leaders. One of the leaders is Ken. And we call it TAG because TAG stands for the Adoptee Group. It's an acronym. And under the TAG Network, we are developing a software application that will match adoptees with adoptee competent therapists through a systematic way. We believe this is going to be like industry changing. And then alongside of the software, we will develop a mentor group for adoptees who don't necessarily need clinical support, but they do need someone to walk alongside of them in their journey. And then third to that is a program called TAG Cares, and that's a funding program for people who cannot afford the sessions, whether it's a, you know, like a life empowerment coach session, a clinical session. We hope to, you know, work with the corporations right now who are very interested in what we're doing further and for the long run to help fund people who need help.
Right. Josh, you want to talk a little bit about your work?
So I think part of what I mentioned before is that we tend to focus in on that we look at suicide numbers. You know, we think of clinical numbers as in depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, these kinds of things. Well, what happens to the majority of folks who experience trauma but are not clinically diagnosed, right? So I think that's where this is the focus I thought was brilliant, is that typically, I call it the 80-20 rule. So folks who experience trauma, about 80% of them will be okay without clinical services. The other 20% are going to need to be assessed, you know, and out of those 20%, even a lesser amount, about 10% will actually probably be diagnosed with a post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, or something like that. So in previous models, we look at really putting all our focus on the folks who really need a lot of clinical attention. And we, granted, are going to focus in on that as well, but I think Jody's vision, and that's what I wanted to really kind of emphasize, is that it's about those other folks, right, that are maybe depressed but not clinically depressed, or that are struggling a little bit but not post-traumatic stress level, kind of, you know, or working a really good job but could do a better job, right, or just need a little bit of fine tuning, some kind of tuning. And I think that's what this program is really looking at. And on the clinical side, the match is important too, is that what I've been finding is that there's not a lot of adoptee competent clinical psychologists or clinicians. And then to put on top of that, for us, finding a Korean adoptee competent one is like, geez, you're not going to find that, right? I mean, if you are, they're so busy that, you know, that they probably can't see you. So I think that's what the software is going to develop, is, hey, on both sides, you have parameters, you have all these kind of algorithms to match folks up with a bit of a choice. So you're not spending so much time trying to find things. And then the contact becomes bi-directional, right? You contact them, they schedule you in, you know, these kinds of things that would be really helpful, because if you're depressed, it's hard to find a therapist, right? I'm expecting you to find me, and it's like, but you're depressed. Like, you don't want to get out of bed. You don't want to do these things, or you're facing some type of trauma or these kinds of things. So I think for us, that focus is on the less clinical side. And what can we do as a group to kind of, as a prevention, right? As a prophylactic, is how do we get folks not to that other 10, 20%? You know, how do we get them not to develop a clinical disorder and be more successful in life? And I think we'd be very successful. I would put 80%, if we were successful with 80% of the Korean adopted group, of getting them what they need, I think that's pretty successful in the clinical world, right? So that's kind of where the emphasis is, but we will have the kind of clinical ability to help those who need more clinical care.
That's great.
And I want to mention one thing too, is Josh has given me a lot of credit in this, but it is a team. And it's important for me to mention that these team members have been walking alongside of us and put in a lot of time and hours as well for this mission. Is it okay if I mention who they are?
Yeah, of course. Sure.
Okay, so it's the Adoptee Group, and we have myself, Jody Gill, Jennifer Worth, Tabitha DuPoy, Ken Angel, Josh Heitzman, and Janice Gerard. That is our leadership. And then we also have a handful of volunteers as well. But it is it does involve a lot of meetings, a lot of research individually, and then bringing to the table beneficial information for the mission.
Brilliant. Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anything you want to ask me, guys, at all? I don't know why I asked that. We good?
I love what you're doing in the community. I love the focus on thriving adoptees.
Thank you. So yeah, thanks. Sorry, Josh.
No, I said I appreciate that too. I think this is what we all really need, right? Is to have these forums to do this in a positive way. And I like the positive twist on it, right? That thriving part, because oftentimes in the clinical world, especially for me, we look at the non-thriving population. Yeah. So it's so wonderful to be part of this.
Yeah. I saw something from an adoptee influencer kind of person, perhaps I call her or him. I'm not sure which, actually. Or maybe it's non-binary, you know, I'm not really up on that sort of stuff. I'm not as well versed in that area as I should be. I saw this stuff, I thought, this is dark. Now, he or she, they, whatever, seems to be, you know, wanting to be a light, you know, wanting to be a positive change. And I'm wondering, why are they putting out all this stuff that is all about darkness and there's no light? There's no light at this isn't, to me, leaders show a light at the end of the tunnel, you know. But sometimes you've got to meet people. Traditionally, you know, you meet people where they're at, but you give them a vision for the future. You can't be a pessimistic leader, right? Nobody wants to follow a pessimistic leader, nobody wants to follow a pessimistic leader. So you start with you've got a positive message, a positive future, and then you talk about the challenges that people are at, and then take them forward. But there seems to be, in the adoption world, there seem to be a lot of people just shoving out 100% dark stuff. Maybe it's to meet people where they're at, but that can't that just kind of reinforce it? You go further and further down the dark hole. Whereas the whole thing with thriving adoptees is, yeah, I've been in the darkness. My darkness is like complete semi-darkness compared to some people have been through. I've had it really easy, far easier than a lot of other people. But I know what that darkness looks like, and I've spent a bit of time in the darkness. But I want to draw people's attention not to where they are in the darkness now, but to the light that's at the end of the tunnel. And that's what thriving adoptees is. It's about a journey. You know, you mentioned the word journey. It is a journey towards the lightness, to counteract all this negative stuff there is out there. There's the deluded stuff, There's the delusional group in adoption, and you know, like it's all flowers and roses, and then there's the black hole group. And with thriving adoptees, I want to be about the light at the end of the tunnel. That's why.
Yeah. Are you looking for a response on that?
I'd love to hear your response on that.
I'm really careful in social media because it's a representation of the community that could more or less be in that 20%. Those who are at the 80% are likely full-time employees or have their own companies and have thriving lives. So social media is not something that they depend upon for any kind of value points in their make. So when I see these people who are influencers and they continue to put out dark posts, I think people might like them for the season that they're in, but then those who are naturally growing will become tired of the dark posts because they're naturally growing toward, thriving. So I think, you know, it's something that we can't control, those influencers who place them out there. I would probably say that they haven't quite found wellness for themselves, or they're playing the social media game and they understand that by putting these kinds of controversial posts, they will get more likes. So again, what is their mission? Is their mission to get more likes so that they have more followers, or is it a mission that truly helps people thrive?
Thanks, guys. Great points. Fantastic conversation.
Thank you, Simon. It was great hanging out with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thanks, folks. See you all soon, listeners. Bye-bye.